I'm really grateful that I got the opportunity to come up here tonight and to introduce all of you to somebody who really needs no introduction. Richard is going to be our first speaker tonight. I first met Richard when I showed up at a meeting that I hadn't been to previously, and there was one guy with a deer in the headlights look at the back of the room and four women. And when he saw me, it was almost like I was there to rescue him. I was in a pretty bad place at the time, and Richard came and talked to me afterwards, and he just seemed like he really needed somebody, some guy, to talk to and be his friend. And I remember phoning my sponsor and saying, I don't know what's with this guy, but he won't let go of me. And George wisely said, I think he probably just needs another guy around. So don't worry about it. It'll be okay. The interesting thing about meeting Richard was, in fact, he's somebody my higher power sent my way. I was seeing a counselor at the time who had suggested to me that it would be well worth my while to pray for my higher power to send people into my life who would help me with my recovery. And lo and behold, there was this fractured guy sitting there who I thought needed more help than me, but, oh, he did? Oh, okay. But that's where our journey began, and it's been a hell of a journey together. Up until I left, I had supper every night on Monday nights with Karen and Richard for a little over 10 years. So that's about 500 suppers. Richard and I have attended somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 meetings together over that time. I gave up keeping track a while ago. And he's become my best friend. So this man I've seen go from desperately needing recovery to being a strong, enthusiastic, and driven member of Al-Anon. I don't know of anybody who works his program as hard as Richard does, who does as much sponsorship, who opens his house to anybody who wants to come in and talk recovery or needs a place to stay, who 10 years ago helped create this festival in this format and was a part of it every year up until he left last year. So without further delay, I give you Richard.
I'm a grateful and enthusiastic member of the Al-Anon Family Groups. My name is Richard Estes.
Hi, Richard.
How many are here for their first festival? Just okay. If you've been here before, you already know that what Ian just did was my favorite 3 minutes of the year, every year. You know, coming up here and looking out on the Friday night and introducing the kickoff speaker, and man, it feels weird to be on the other side of that 5 minutes. Wow. I am a product of Saskatoon Al-Anon. I am a product of the Steps to Freedom Al-Anon Family Group. I'm a product of the New Awareness Al-Anon Family Group, and formerly the Foundations Al-Anon Family Group. My home group today is the Changed Attitudes Al-Anon Family Group, Winnipeg, Manitoba. We meet Saturday afternoons at 3:30 at St. Stephen's Anglican Church, 220 Helmsdale Avenue. We believe that alcoholism is a family disease and that changed attitudes can aid recovery. If you're ever in Winnipeg on a Saturday afternoon, please call us, and especially if you are familiar with any of those groups I just named here. I'll take you to a meeting you're going to love. It's going to feel real familiar. My sponsor is Jack C. Yeah, the same Jack C. that's speaking tomorrow night. I'm pretty sure there are a couple of you here who have been waiting for an opportunity to report my behavior to someone. Jack will be setting up a booth at the back of the room tomorrow after the sponsorship workshop. And by the way, if that doesn't do it for you, my mom will be in the next booth. This is a little weird for me. I've got my best friend, I've got my sponsor, I've got my wife, I've got my mother, I've got my oldest daughter, and a bunch of people who have watched me grow up in Al-Anon here, so I don't think I've ever had to be quite this rigorously honest. Because if I make a mistake, I'm sure somebody's going to be able to correct me later. What we're asked to do when we do this is that we share in a general way about what we were like and what happened to us and what we're like today, with an emphasis on the tools of the program that we use to recover. And I'm going to try to do that to the best of my ability tonight. First thing I like to do when I get up here is to establish that I have a place here, that I identify as an Al-Anon. Al-Anon has a tradition that says that the only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or a friend. So I need to establish with you that I meet that requirement. I am the son of two alcoholics. My mother's been sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for a little over 20 years. For that, I'm very grateful, and I think she is too. My father is yet to find sobriety. So I qualify to be a member of Al-Anon because I'm the son of two alcoholics. I'm also the grandson of alcoholics. I'm also the nephew of alcoholics, the cousin of alcoholics. I got a couple of brothers whose drinking worries me at times. Over the years, I've been the employee, the employer, and the coworker with a great number of alcoholics. And during my formative years, most of the guys I hung out with drank like them, the them in your life. And when I outlined all of this down at Addiction Services one day to Family Day crowd, a young guy at the back of the room goes, "Man, you're overqualified." So if you're someone like the lady I share my life with, who shows up in Al-Anon and goes, these people are talking about feelings I recognize, but I don't know, I can't point to an alcoholic in my family, and you feel like maybe you're not sure if you qualify to be here, and because you can't find an alcoholic, let me know. I will lend you one. I have lots. So I'm eminently qualified to be a member of Al-Anon, but maybe the most important thing I can tell you is that not one of the alcoholics in my life is the reason that I go to Al-Anon. See, one of the first things that you taught me in Al-Anon was the three C's. The three C's say I didn't cause someone else's alcoholism, I can't control someone else's alcoholism, and I can't cure someone else's alcoholism. And if the only reason I'm going to Al-Anon is because of someone else's drinking, I've got a problem, because the three C's tell me that I can't fix that. If the only way for me to get better is for someone else to drink, to stop drinking, then the three C's tell me I'm screwed. So I never, ever these days go to an Al-Anon meeting because of someone else's drinking, because anybody in my life has a drinking problem. I go because I have a thinking problem. Looking at it here in Al-Anon, I've discovered that growing up at the intersection of three families affected by alcoholism affected the way I see the world. That it was in those families that I learned everything I know about functioning as an adult. It's where I learned how to be a son. It's where I learned how to be a brother. It's where I learned how to, by observation, how to be a father and a husband and a worker and a citizen and a neighbor. And the people teaching me those things were all either alcoholics or people who'd been affected by alcoholics, and a lot of the stuff that they had to teach me wasn't in my best interest. So I don't go to Al-Anon because of someone else's drinking problem. I go because I have a thinking problem. And I like to describe it as the disease of I think I know stuff. And the way that works is I'll believe something that I think I know. I'll believe it deep in my heart. And I'll make life-changing decisions based on this thing that I think I know. And I'll later find out that it wasn't true. Just as a an insight into my family. My favorite story is comes to me from my maternal uncle. It's about my maternal grandfather. So my mom's brother and my mom's dad. Now, my Uncle Bob was a teenager at the time that this happened. It's strictly hearsay, but I trust the source. And the way he tells it is that my Grandpa Smith was a feisty little guy. He was a Friday night drinker. He was a former Golden Gloves boxer, and he was a car hunter. And a couple of you are going, what the heck is car hunting? Well, what would happen is my uncle, a teenager, would be doing what teenagers do on a Saturday morning, sleeping in. And somebody would tap him on the shoulder. Bob, get up. What? Bob, get up. What? Bob, you got to get up. Dad, it's 6 o'clock Saturday morning. What do you want? You got to get up. You got to take me downtown. You got to help me find my car before your mother gets up. And they would go car hunting. They would cruise the side streets and the parkades in downtown Saskatoon. They'd figure out where my grandfather had lost his car the night before. And they would go back to the house, and my grandfather would make breakfast. Now, I have it on the authority of my uncle that my grandfather died many years later, firmly believing that my grandmother never suspected a thing. See, the little chuckles there tell me I'm in an Al-Anon meeting. See, here's what I think happened. I think my grandmother got up on a Saturday morning, and she smelled the bacon cooking, and she went, Manly lost the car again last night. But then she would do something really important, and that is that she would say nothing. Now, nobody ever sat me down as a little kid and said, Richard, this is the way the world works, and these are the things that we want you to learn to get along in the world. But I learned some things growing up in those families. One of the things that I learned was that if I screw up and you don't know about it, I'm okay. I also learned that if I screw up and you know about it, but we don't talk about it, I'm okay. I was 40 years old and in Al-Anon before I found out that those things weren't true. I learned some other things, and I need to tell you, especially with my mom sitting here, that I'm not here to complain about my family. This is just the way it turned out. There's nobody to blame here. But I learned that love is conditional. I don't think anybody set out to teach me that, but I learned at an early age that how much you love me today depends on how much I pleased you today. I learned that what you want is more important than what I want. And I became a people pleaser. I became a scorekeeper. I became a people watcher. We talked about that in a meeting last night a little bit. That idea that I would watch you like a hawk. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to figure out what you're going to do next so that I can do it so closely behind you that it looks like I did it with you. Because I want so desperately to belong. And when I guess wrong, it gets spectacular. I did what those of us who grew up in alcoholic families have a tendency to do. You don't go to Al-Anon adult children meetings for very long before you conclude that we only ever seem to end up with two kinds of people. We marry alcoholics or we marry each other. And then we settle down to make each other crazier. So I went out and I found myself another woman from another sick family, and we had a couple of kids, and when that marriage broke up a few years later, those kids were really the most important thing to come out of that. And I went to my then wife, who was having problems with her own compulsive behaviors, and I said to her, you know, your life's really kind of mixed up right now, and I think the kids would be better off if they were with me. And she agreed. And I became this instant single dad. And it was great. There he is, poor, noble Richard with those two adorable little girls, and you know, and that wife off in jail, and what a guy, you know. And I look great to you guys. And the thing that I'm not really proud of today is that was a big part of why I did that. That I knew going into that breakup that I would look better as the single dad than as the visiting dad. And so now I've become the kind of guy who makes life-changing decisions for the two most important people in his life based on how I look to you. After that breakup, I was sitting in the office of a counselor who gave me that advice that we're all so familiar with. You know, Richard, you're a little broken right now, and you need to grieve and heal, and I really think you should take a break from relationships. For how long? 1 year. So about a year and a day later, I met another sick woman from another sick family, and I pursued her to the gates of insanity or death. Actually, what happened was she said to me those magic words. Those words that are guaranteed to take a guy like me from mildly interested to head over heels in love. What she said to me was, "Yes, I will go out with you again." And we settled down to make each other crazier. I fell in love. We had a baby, and we got married in that order. And we settled down to make each other crazier. Now, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous describes an illness that is progressive and chronic and fatal in its nature. And I happen to believe that not just alcoholism, but the family disease of alcoholism is progressive and chronic and fatal in its nature. The progressive nature of the family disease of alcoholism as it expresses itself in my life looks like this. Is that over any extended period of time, what it will do is it will make my world smaller. Little by little. The way that looks is, did you hear what Greg said to me? Did you hear what he said? I'm not gonna tolerate that. Now I've got a resentment. I'm gonna start investing time and energy figuring out where he's gonna be, what he's gonna be doing, who he's gonna be doing it with, so I can cut him out of my life. I'm gonna avoid him and cut him out of my life, and my world just got smaller. And then Tammy saw that mistake that I made. A defect of character coming to the surface, and it's embarrassing. And I kind of don't feel right facing her these days, so I'm going to start figuring out where she's going to be and what she's going to be doing and who she's going to be doing it with so I can avoid her so I don't have to face that. And my world got smaller. These guys over here, you know, we're pretty good buddies. Really enjoy hanging out with them. There's a problem, though. She doesn't like them. They got to go. And my world gets smaller. And when you're a people pleaser, you have a tendency to promise more things to more people than you can accommodate. And sooner or later, somebody's going to get hurt. And, you know, these guys here, I mean, I really screwed them over, and they're really mad at me. I know they're really mad at me. I haven't talked about it, but I know they're really mad at me. And I got to start avoiding them. And my world gets smaller. This guy over here, the only problem is that he's just tired of the drama and the crap that I bring, and he's cut me out of his life. And my world gets smaller. You know, by the time I got to my first Al-Anon meeting, my world had shrunk to me and the woman who was the center of my obsessions, and she was leaving. And I did what any macho guy would do in that situation. I fell apart. I had a nervous breakdown. And I ended up curled up on the couch of a therapist who said to me, I know today what he said to me was, Richard, I could work with you for a long time, and we could see some improvement, but you just stop coming to see me, and you'd go back to the way you were, and I think you need a different kind of help. What I heard was, you're a long-term project, and I want to retire someday. Go see these people. And he sent me to you. And I walked into that first Al-Anon meeting. I was in the shape that I love to see newcomers in today. I was absolutely broken. And because I was broken, I was open to a new idea. I walked into that first Al-Anon meeting shattered. And I cried all the way through that first meeting. And I love today. We've all had that experience of a newcomer coming to our meeting and crying a little bit, sniffling, and then apologizing for crying in an Al-Anon meeting. I love that. Apologizing for crying in an Al-Anon meeting just seems so weird to me. And sometimes I'll have this kind of irreverent thought, like, you call that crying? No. That's sniffling. What I did in my first meeting, that was crying. I'm talking about the animal noise, snot-slinging kind of crying that drowns out the person who's trying to share. And where's Terry? Terry, put your hand up. Terry was there. She can vouch for this. I did it for an hour. And at the end of the meeting, a marvelous thing happened. Nobody judged me. Nobody criticized the 40-year-old guy who was crying like a little kid and disturbing the meeting. Nobody made fun of me. All he did was at the end of the meeting, they hugged me and they told me they loved me in a very special way. And they asked me to come back next week. And that was the first experience I'd had with unconditional love in a very long time. And hooked me into coming back that week. And the next week when I walked out, I noticed that I felt better than I did walking in. That hooked me into coming back for another week. And that kept me coming back for a while until I started noticing some of the people in the meeting. You know, there were people in that meeting who had grown up in way worse households than anything I'd ever experienced. I mean, I have friends today who've had truly horrific childhoods. And, you know, I had a pretty vanilla childhood. I mean, most of my misery was right here between my ears. Didn't need anybody else's intervention. But there were people who'd gone through truly horrific childhoods, or who were living today in a situation far worse than anything I was experiencing. And they were happy. And they were smiling, and they were laughing in the meeting. And I wanted what they had, whatever that was. And I noticed that the people who had what I wanted all seemed to talk about the same things. They talked about going to meetings, not just one meeting a week, but they talked about going to lots of meetings. They talked about having this thing called a sponsor. They would say things like, yeah, I had lunch with my sponsor yesterday. And you know those 12 steps that they insist on reading at the beginning of every meeting? Like every damn meeting they read them. Right? They talked about those from the point of view of actually having done them. Well, we have this saying around here, if you want what we've got, do what we did. Or if my problem looks like your problem, then the thing that worked for you just might work for me. And I was hearing the broken record that we talk about. Come to the meetings, get a sponsor, work the steps. Come to the meetings, get a sponsor, work the steps. By the way, come to the meetings and get a sponsor, work the steps. Well, at that point in my life, I'm pretty sure that I was certifiable, but I've never been stupid. I started going to a lot of meetings. And I got up the nerve to ask a guy who kind of looked like Santa Claus and sounded like God to be my sponsor. And I started working the steps. Now, I've heard it said that newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous have a tendency to work the steps hard as if their life depends on it. Remember chronic and progressive and fatal illness? You know, they do that because they've got this big blue book that tells them that their life depends on it, that if they drink, they're going to die. So they work the steps as if their life depends on it. I got to tell you that I kind of understand that reasoning. I understand that motivation. 2 years before I got to my first Al-Anon meeting, my oldest cousin on my dad's side of my family, the guy that was my hero when I was little, mainly because he protected me from the next biggest cousin, but a guy that everybody loved, determined one day that he couldn't live with his wife's choices anymore, and he walked into his backyard and he threw a rope over a beam and he hung himself. Almost exactly a year later, and almost exactly a year before my first Al-Anon meeting, the youngest cousin on my mom's side of the family, just a delightful young guy, I mean, everybody's favorite, the life of the party, but the only one of her kids still in contact with my alcoholic aunt, wrote a note detailing his personal sense of failure, and he put a shotgun under his chin and he pulled the trigger. 6 months before my first Al-Anon meeting, my younger brother, big tough career Army guy, was being treated for depression, and they were keeping him away from anything that went bang. And when I walked into that first meeting, I just wanted the pain to stop. And I was starting to think of all sorts of interesting ways to make the pain stop. And I think to this day that the thing that kept me from doing something irreversible, from, you know, the permanent solution to a temporary problem, was this thought that came into my head one day: Richard, you shit yourself when you die. And I didn't want to be found that way. So I understand that idea of working the steps as if your life depends on it, because I happen to believe that mine does. You know, and even if somebody like me doesn't go all the way down that road, I don't ever want to go back to where I was, because that wasn't living. You know, that was dying a day at a time was what I was doing. Step one says that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I had a problem with that, right? I was 40 years old. It had been 20 years since I lived with day-to-day alcoholism. Right? And I couldn't understand, you know, like a lot of Al-Anon members, it's, you know, they've got the drinking problem. They've got the problem with alcohol. What's up with us doing the same first step as AA? And I don't know if you've noticed, but AA members can be very, very helpful. And Al-Anon members can be very helpful. We are predisposed to be helpful. So I would have Al-Anon members coming to me saying, Richard, it's really simple. What it means is that we're powerless over the alcoholic. Big deal. I was 8 years old and I knew I was powerless over alcoholics. I mean, you go to any of my family functions, try to make a drunk do something. Didn't work. Powerless over alcoholic. Big deal. This is not new information. Somebody else would come along and say, well, what it means is that we're powerless over the effects of alcohol on the alcoholic. Well, I knew that too. Right? Pour 3 ounces of rye into my grandfather. You couldn't predict the results. And besides, what's that got to do with me today? Now, my first Al-Anon meeting was the Foundations Group. Which is now defunct, but the Foundations Group was an Al-Anon adult children group here in town. And really, the thing that separates an Al-Anon adult children group apart from a regular Al-Anon meeting is one thing. Somewhere during the course of the meeting, usually at the beginning, they will read some piece of the literature that speaks to the experience of growing up in a home affected by alcoholism. That's it. After that, it's an Al-Anon meeting. But at the Foundations Group, they read a particular pamphlet that came to mean a lot to me. I'd like to share with you what they read to me every week. Most of you are probably familiar with this. The little teal pamphlet says, "Did you grow up with a problem drinker? Al-Anon is for you. Al-Anon is for families, relatives, and friends whose lives have been affected by someone else's drinking. If someone close to you, such as a family member, friend, coworker, or neighbor, has or has had a drinking problem, the following questions may help you to determine if Al-Anon is for you. Do you constantly seek approval and affirmation? Do you fail to recognize your accomplishments? Do you fear criticism? Do you overextend yourself? Have you had problems with your own compulsive behavior? Do you have a need for perfection? Are you uneasy when your life is going smoothly, continually anticipating problems? Do you feel more alive in the midst of a crisis? Do you feel responsible for others as you did for the problem drinker in your life? Do you care for others easily yet find it difficult to care for yourself? Do you isolate yourself from other people? Do you respond with fear to authority figures and angry people? Do you feel that individuals and society in general are taking advantage of you? Do you have trouble with intimate relationships? Do you confuse pity with love, as you did with the problem drinker? Do you attract or seek people who tend to be compulsive or abusive? Do you cling to relationships because you're afraid of being alone? Do you often mistrust your own feelings and the feelings expressed by others? Do you find it difficult to identify and express your emotions? Do you think someone's drinking may have affected you?" Sound like anybody you've met recently? How'd you score? I'll tell you, I passed this quiz with flying colors. And here's the thing. All my life, I'd had that constant feeling, being lonely and separate and different and afraid, feeling like I was on the outside looking in. Feeling, you know, the world was divided into two groups. There was me and everybody else, right? And somehow or other, I just couldn't seem to get into that other group. Nobody could ever understand how I feel. Nobody could understand the things I've done. Nobody could understand the thoughts that I can't seem to keep at bay. Because I'm unique, you know. And I found myself in a room full of people who were all unique the same way. And what suddenly happened was my world got a little bit bigger. Because I was with people who got it. And that's been my experience with every single one of the steps, the traditions, the slogans, sponsorship, every tool of recovery, is every single piece of it works directly against the effects of this family disease in my life by making my world a little bigger. And what I did in step one was I came face to face with one simple fact. I'm powerless over the ways I've been affected by someone else's alcoholism. I didn't pick any of these things. They seemed to pick me. And boy, was my life unmanageable as a result of that. Now, what step one does is it creates the need for the second step. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Came to believe that there was something out there that could fix this. Right? Because if step one is true, step two had better be true or I'm screwed. And what happened here, I got here a lifelong agnostic. Not just any kind of agnostic, the really annoying kind. The kind with the knee-jerk reaction to the G word. And if you said God in my presence, we were going to have a little conversation because you were obviously confused about something and you needed to be corrected for your own good. Just trying to be of service. And the thing is that the second step scared the crap out of me because what it meant was I would have to admit that I may have been mistaken. And what happened here was that I was led to an experiment. The idea that, "Richard, we understand that you don't believe there's anything out there, or if there is something out there, that it It's not listening. But you say you've got this very logical bent of mind, and you believe in the scientific method. So let's put forward a hypothesis. Let's test the hypothesis. Okay, just for 2 weeks. Try talking to something as if it, yeah, we know it's not there. We know it's not there. Just talk to something as if it were there for 2 weeks and report back the result. If at the end of 2 weeks you say you got nothing back, we'll leave you alone. Okay. So I started talking to something I knew wasn't there. Or if it was there, it wasn't listening. And I didn't make it 2 weeks. Inside of 48 hours, I got an answer back that I couldn't deny. And I came to believe that there was something out there that cared about me, that was listening, that wanted the best for me. I had to conclude it was probably smarter than me, probably wiser than me, might even be better looking than me. But bottom line is that it was a hell of a lot better than the nothing that I'd had before. And I made the decision in the third step to turn my will and my life over to the care of this higher power that I'd just been introduced to. I believe today that the third step is the program. That the third step is the program in its entirety. First two steps only exist to get me to that decision in the third step where the action happens, where I become transformed. I go in the front end of that decision in the third step, this frightened and selfish and self-centered man who can't seem to live. And I decide that one day at a time, I'm going to try to do the things that I think a loving higher power would have me do. Try to live according to different principles. I'm a different guy. I'm still frightened, and I'm still selfish, and I'm still self-centered, and I have no idea how to turn my will and my life over to the care of a loving higher power. But that's why this isn't a three-step program, because what 4 through 12 are all about is teaching me how to implement that decision. But the decision is the key. The fourth step, I'm asked to go back through my life to examine all of those moments, all of those resentments, all of the wreckage that I strew in my wake. And I'm asked to do an interesting thing. I'm asked to look at that situation from the other person's point of view for a minute. Boy, does my world get bigger at that point. When I start looking at my behavior from the other point of view and recognizing what I did to contribute to that situation. And I'm asked to have a look at my fears. I'm asked to have a look at my conduct and my relationships throughout my life. And one more time, looking for selfishness and self-centeredness and dishonesty and fear. Not with the point of, with the idea of condemning myself, but from the point of view of looking at what could I do better? What can a loving higher power take me forward through? What could be corrected here? Now, I tried to do the perfect fourth step. I tried to do the perfect fourth step several times. Who else here has tried to do the perfect fourth step? Okay. We know why we try to do the perfect fourth step, right? Because we've read ahead to the fifth step, right? We know the perfect fourth step cannot be done. And as long as I'm trying to do the fourth step perfectly, I never have to do the fifth step. Yeah. I never have to, and I don't mind admitting to God and to myself the exact nature of my wrongs. It's that other human being. For a while, I had this fantasy. I was going to do my fifth step with a blind priest dying of cancer in Calgary. You know, come on, it was perfect, right? I'd go there. I would tell him all that crap that was in my fourth step. And as I was driving out of Calgary to return home to Saskatoon, he would die. And it would be back to just me. I wouldn't have to leave anybody walking around knowing that stuff. But that's not the way it works. What happened for me was I ended up in a meeting of the Steps to Freedom group one Saturday afternoon, and a couple of longtime members shared some things that made it, it was a meeting on the fifth step, and they shared some things that made it okay for me to finish the fourth step. So I finished the fourth step, and I went to my sponsor, and I did the usual dance. Well, I got my fourth step done, and what do I do now? And we do the fifth step. Well, who do I do the fifth step with? He said coyly, because he doesn't want to have to actually ask. And my sponsor let me dance for a while until he finally got frustrated. He said, okay, be at my house on Friday at 7:30. He's just tired of me dancing around. So now I've got an appointment to read my fourth step Friday at 7:30. Friday at 8:15, I'm still writing. Because I realized there was a few things I needed to write down yet. So I get to his place, and we do a seven-hour conversation. And at the end of that seven-hour conversation, he didn't say to me, you waste of skin, you useless piece of crap, please get off my property and never darken my doorstep again. He didn't say that. What he said was, Richard, I love you. Go home and get some sleep. And I got up the next day, and there was someone else walking around who knew it all. My world got a lot bigger that day. We get into 6 and 7. I love 7 in retrospect. I love 7 after it's happened. I hate being in the middle of it. Here's my experience with 7. 7th step says we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. Nowhere in there does he say he's going to do it now, right? And what happens in my experience is that my higher power is going to present me with an opportunity to practice a defect of character. So I will, because that's what I do. But this time I notice it, because it was on that inventory, and it bothers me. I was like, this is uncomfortable. And a couple days later, I'll get another opportunity to practice the same defect of character, and I'll see it coming. It's like, oh, crap, I don't want to do this again. But then I'll do it. And it's even more uncomfortable this time. And it's going to keep coming at me, and it's going to keep coming at me until I do something different. That first time that I get the opportunity to that I actually observe myself doing something different is interesting. One of my big defects of character is the need to be right. I have a brother who shares that defect of character with me, and he and I can argue, just go at it hammer and tong for an hour. Right? Just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And we're getting personal, and our voices are raised, and we're just trying to beat the other guy over the head with our point. What's interesting, if you step back from it, is we're both saying the same thing. But the reason we can do this for an hour is because the other guy's saying it wrong. And I remember the first time that I was able to say to him, okay, and walk away. It was the first time that I was invited to a fight that I didn't show up for and walked away. I was like 20 feet away. I was like, wait a second, what just happened? I had to phone Ian. You know what just happened? I just turned down an argument with my brother. And he gets it. He understood. And that's one of the things that happens here is that we have the weirdest idea of personal victory. And yet we share it with each other. You know? We come here and we laugh about the things that used to make us cry. I love that. The 8th and 9th step, we get the opportunity to go back and to put right to the best of our ability, to repair the relationships that I broke. And little by little, my world gets bigger. The 10th step and the 11th step. Well, the 10th step is the insurance policy for me. I refer to it as the sport of Richard watching. I go through my day looking over Richard's shoulder, watching for selfishness, self-centeredness, dishonesty, and fear, and those old behaviors. I remember one of the people that I had to make a living amends to was a woman in my workplace. She was a very bitter, very angry woman. She had been horribly hurt by a guy in her life, and kind of projected that out at anybody with a Y chromosome. But on top of that, I mean, she was just an angry person. And in the years before I got to Al-Anon, I treated her with a lot of disrespect. I met her anger with anger. I did some things that I wasn't really proud of. So I started to treat her with courtesy and respect on a daily basis to the best of my ability. And one day about, I think, 5 years into recovery, through an office wall, because the walls were very thin, I heard her talking to a delivery guy and referring to me in a derogatory manner. Well, I thought about that for a second. I thought, you know, I really should go discuss that with her. And I walked through the door into that warehouse fully believing I had things under control. And inside of about 40 seconds, I was a spitting, drooling idiot. I was screaming at her. I was swearing at her. And I stormed out. And I drove home. And I phoned Ian and I turned myself in. And Ian, bless his heart, said, you know, you're going to have to make amends to her. Yeah, I know, goddammit. So I got back in the car and I drove back to my office, and all the way to my office, I'm thinking to myself, geez, you know, this could be a lawsuit. She could go to the Human Rights Commission about this. You could do this. And well, now I latch on to the idea that, okay, but you know what? I'm going back to make amends. I am practicing a spiritual program of recovery. I am on the moral high ground here. Wait for it. I get back there. I walk in. I go up to talk to her. And I said, I need to talk to you. She said, I need to talk to you. No, I need to talk. No. And this angry, bitter, vindictive woman insisted on apologizing to me first. I had a resentment for that for a while because I... But that, to me, was the 10th step in action. That, you know, I didn't even get out to the parking lot and the 10th step was kicking my ass. I knew what he was going to say before I phoned him. And it keeps my world from getting smaller. 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. I am truly blessed these days. Remember that woman who was leaving me when I first got to Al-Anon? She never quite got out the door. And what happened was that I got here to you people, and I started doing the deal, and I started changing and growing a little bit, and boy, did that bug her. Apparently there's nothing worse than somebody in the house is growing spiritually and it's not you. And she figured she better check this thing out. You should hear her story sometime. She tried the home study program and determined that didn't work. But she ended up coming and check you guys out. And she stuck. And today she is one of the Al-Anon members who I most respect for the program that she works in the face of adversity. And I, as a result, I get to share my 11th step with the lady that I share my life with. Our morning routine is that we get up in the morning and we have coffee together and we do the 3rd and 7th step prayers, and we read from some of the readers, And we close with a serenity prayer, and we have our own little mini meeting together first thing every morning. Boy, is that a better way to start the day than what we used to do. The 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And to me, the 12th step is a call to sponsorship. Because what happens now, I get to live a life so different from when I got here. I get to be one of those people who's laughing in the meeting, who's happy to be alive. And every once in a while, some guy walks into one of my meetings and he's falling apart and he's bleeding and his hair's on fire and he's falling apart because of something that she said or something that she did. And he'll come up to me and say, I love the recovery that I see in you, and can you show me how you did that? And I get to walk that guy through the same process. And one of the most profound experiences in my life these days is to take a guy like that by the hand and walk him through the first few steps and get a ringside seat when the light comes on in his eyes. That is one of the most powerful things in my life today. And those guys save my life on a regular basis. You know, I mentioned before I'm this lifelong agnostic. Well, I stand before you today, an agnostic with a higher power, and I love the irony of this, an agnostic with favorite prayers. Right. One of my favorite prayers is my, what I refer to as the shit has hit the fan prayer. Okay. And it goes like this. Because life doesn't get perfect after recovery. It still happens. Things still happen to me, and I still need to figure out how to deal with them. And sometimes when it gets overwhelming, I pray this prayer. Father, I'm angry, and I'm frustrated, and I'm hurting, and I'm scared. I'm starting to feel sorry for myself. Please send me someone to help. I love the service that I get on that prayer. My higher power is right on that one. I've ended that prayer and had the phone ring right then. I've prayed that prayer, gone to the meeting. There's the newcomer who really needs to talk. I've prayed that prayer, and my doorbell rings a half an hour later, and it's one of those guys. Yeah. Usually upset because of something she said or something she did. And we sit down and we talk it out. I talk them down off the ledge, and we figure out whether or not there's any amends that need to be made here. Or any boundaries that need to be set and where to go from here. And by the time I'm done talking to this guy, I've forgotten what I was upset about. And the other effect of that usually is that I come away from that conversation and I am very much in love with my wife, usually because she's not his wife. And Karen's come to expect it. You know, I'll get off the phone. I'll get off the phone and she'll walk in the room and I'm just like, and she sees the look on my face and she goes, who called? Who was it? Come on. And those guys make my world bigger. If you look at my life today, it's really not horribly different than it was before I got here. You know, I'm still doing the same kind of work. I'm still married to the same woman. I've got the same family. Well, you know, when I got here, I had these three daughters who were afraid of me because I was this angry workaholic who would come home and scream at them. And the reason I would scream at them was because I couldn't talk to her. And I was married to this angry, psychotic little brunette who refused to be happy, no matter how hard I tried to make her be happy. And I was a workaholic who was on the verge of getting fired from a place where he was a partner. Let me assure you, that takes some doing. I'm glad my incompetence amuses you. Today, you know, I do the same kind of work, and like I said, I love what I do. I don't necessarily love doing it where I'm doing it every day, but I love what I do for a living. And I've got those same kids, and I guarantee you that not one of them is afraid of me today. One of them's here tonight. A couple of years ago, Ian and I turned 50, and his girlfriend and my wife threw us a birthday party. And all three of my kids were there. Two of them had to travel to be there. And I, even just a few years earlier, I can promise you that that wouldn't have happened. And my marriage to that angry little brunette today is one of the central joys of my life. So, you know, the circumstances of my life really haven't changed that much, but what's changed is the way that I get to experience those. Yeah. My home group is called the Changed Attitudes Al-Anon Family Group. You hear it in every Al-Anon meeting. We believe that alcoholism is a family disease and that changed attitudes can aid recovery. What's a change in attitude? It's a change in perspective, a change in my point of view, a change in the way that I look at things. And that's what you've given me, what you've helped me to get to, is to see my life through that new pair of glasses that a famous AA speaker talked about many years ago. Makes a powerful, powerful difference in my life. Last year, Karen and I moved from here, where we knew so many of you and loved so many of you, to Winnipeg. And I know that a couple of our friends from Winnipeg arrived while I was talking here, and yeah, we've met some wonderful people there, and we're building a new spiritual family. I see you guys at the back. Love you. We're building a new spiritual family there, and that doesn't mean that we forgot about the old one. But we had to leave this family that meant so much to us. Leave the home group that meant so much to me, another that meant so much to Karen, and go there. And I'll tell you, it was an exercise to make that decision. I ended up having to call. How many times did I talk to you about that, Jack? I remember calling Jack, going, "Man, the Al-Anon in Winnipeg sucks. You know, Saskatoon has." At the time, it was 23 meetings a week. There's a meeting somewhere in Saskatoon every day. Winnipeg is three times the size. They only have two more meetings a week. They have 25 meetings. And out of those, there are no weekend meetings. My home group's a Saturday afternoon adult children group, I'll have you know. They have no adult children meetings in Winnipeg. And by the way, out of those 25 meetings, 11 of them are on Tuesday. Jack laughed hysterically. He says, "You know, Richard, that's not 11 meetings. That's one meeting and 10 people with a resentment and a coffee pot." And Jack says to me, "Richard, do you know what this sounds like to me? A target-rich environment." You know, and it talks about it in AA's big book at the very end. It talks about how if you go and you do God's work, the fellowship that you crave will grow up around you. So we went there and we started a Saturday afternoon adult children meeting. And today, only, 10 months later, it's one of the biggest meetings in Winnipeg. And little by little, the fellowship that we crave is growing up around us there. And we really do hope that you'll come to visit us. I want you to know that when we moved, we made a point of keeping our Saskatchewan phone numbers. So if you've had our phone number, dial it. We're there. Area code didn't even change. So this fellowship, I believe, saved my life. That walking into that place where I got to experience unconditional love for the first time in a very long time kept me from making a very ugly mistake, and I believe this fellowship saved my life. I believe that the 12 steps of this program saved my sanity. And I believe that our 12 traditions saved my marriage. I can't begin to describe the gifts that I've been given here. The fact that I get to feel comfortable in my skin for the first time in my life. The fact that I get to enjoy a marriage that I couldn't have imagined was available to me. The fact that I get to enjoy... I get to enjoy love. And by love, I mean a completely different definition than that watching TV, seeing it in the movies, and by the way, observing dysfunctional families' version of love that I had before I got here. I get to love. I get to enjoy a genuine concern for someone else's well-being combined with a willingness to get up off the couch and do something about it. That's love to me. And all that's asked for me in return is that I get up in front of a room full of crazy people every once in a while and cry into a podium. I'm dramatically overpaid. Thank you so much for having me, especially at this event that has meant so much in my recovery. I love you all. Thank you for letting me share.